I guess today I'm going to talk about major element composition of the mantle. How well do we know it? And then talk a little bit about the possibility of some heterogeneities, major element heterogeneities, things that we might actually be able to see geophysically. I didn't get a chance to upload things, but actually, at one point in my life, I kind of wrote up some stuff. You know, how do we actually estimate bulk soil earth composition? Some ideas on differentiation, and then these are on my website, and they're kind of written for the non-specialist anyway, so that should be okay. And then also on Saturday, I'll talk about trace element geochemistry of partitioning, and I have a chapter on that. And also on my website, there's an easy access to rock compositions if you want to get like bulk circuit earth, chondrites, continental crust, whatever. And also there's, you know, check out the GERM website, any of these other compilations like GeoRock, RidgePetDB, which some of you have already looked at in the previous tutorial. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the bulk silicate earth, but I'm going to forget to cite a lot of people, but these are some of the greats in the field. And I think one of them is here, Stan Hart, in there, so he's in our audience. But okay, so this one I'm going to talk about, bulk silicate earth, major element composition, how well is it known? And then I'm going to talk a little bit how does some of the heterogeneity in major elements originate. We'll touch very briefly on the mass proportions of the reservoirs, quote-unquote reservoirs, and what is the spatial distribution of these heterogeneities. And then lastly, I will kind of address the issue of whether the mantle is actually stratified in terms of major elements, not trace elements. And the reason why we want to look at major elements is because they actually, as we heard from Lars's talk, they define the mineralogy of the mantle, and these are going to control density, velocity, and viscosity. So they're going to have geodynamic and geophysical implications that we're interested in. Okay, so the problem that we have, so what I want to do is start off with a reference state. What is the bulk silicate earth composition? What do I mean by bulk silicate earth? Well, the earth, you can subdivide it, the first order, into the metallic core, which we heard from Sujre formed about 30 million years after the condensation of the solar nebula. And then you have this other part, the silicate part, which includes our present-day mantle and all of this other junk, the continental crust, oceanic lithosphere, and they're all silicates. And if you were to rehomogenize this all back together, we would call that the bulk silicate earth. Clearly, the continental crust has been coming out since progressively since the Archean. Oceanic crust has also been forming, been recycled. So what was our starting point? And the problem we have that we face is the earth has unmixed. It's differentiating. And so how do we get back at the starting point? But before I do that, just a few slides so that we're just clear on what I mean by heterogeneity. Heterogeneity is just a really qualitative term describing how well mixed or unmixed the system is. And another term, reservoirs, are chemically distinct regions in the system that have physically defined boundaries. So I've drawn these with no scale at all, black one type of reservoir, white another one, and this is just random right here. And you have, when you talk about heterogeneities, you have to worry about length scales. So here are there's a bimodal distribution, and if I sample very small, of course, you're going to get a bimodal distribution in kind of composition. You start to sample at greater sizes, you start to smear this out together. And when you sample at a length scale much larger than the heterogeneity length scales, you should get some sort of normal distribution like this from the central limit theorem. Okay. So when we look at the Earth, you can worry about heterogeneities on the centimeter or millimeter length scale. This is a prototype zenolith. Or you can worry about them on tens or hundreds or thousands of kilometer length scales. And for our purposes in this talk, we're not that worried about this length scale. We want to kind of worry about this. And don't worry about all these different reservoirs, just note that they're different colors, and we will come back to that. Okay, so the Earth is heterogeneous on many length scales, and what we want to do is really simplify this to generate a model for the bulk silicate Earth. So once again, here's your bulk Earth in the beginning. It's all mixed up together. You formed the core within the first 30 million years, and you have what remains as the bulk silicate Earth, or we can also call this the primitive mantle. And sometime between then and now, we've differentiated, and this is really simplified, into continental oceanic crust, depleted residuum, which is the complement to the extraction of continental crust and oceanic crust, and any sorts of primordial or primitive mantle that remained and or that may not have been processed through this whole factory of whatever these arrows are, the physical process going on. And we're just going to focus on this part here. We're not going to worry so much on the possibility that there was a very early crustal differentiation that Sujoy talked about in his talk. Okay, so just as a reminder, here's the silicate part of the Earth, and differentiation is going to occur where you basically get melting. So at mid-ocean ridges, you get melting by decompression melting. You've got plumes here. And then in arcs, you have decompression melting as well as flux melting caused by depression of the solidus by addition of volatiles with water. And that's just shown here. Here is the solidus, here's the liquidus, pressure, temperature. Here's the wet solidus. This gray line is the solid mantle adiabat. These lines are just geotherms that are constrained here by surface heat flows. And you can see that if you're underneath the ridge, having a potential temperature, say, 1350 degrees, potential temperature, which we'll talk about in the tutorial this afternoon, is the temperature at which, if you were to take the mantle down here and bring it up a solid adiabat to the surface, that potential temperature. Anyway, you start down here in solids, and then you cross the solidus, and you start melting. And one of the things that's important to note is that for most of Earth's history, our potential temperature, well, probably was hotter in the past, but you have to actually get pretty high to melt the mantle completely, 100% melting. So you're normally in this region where you only get what we call partial melting. And partial melting is important because that's where you actually start to fractionate that major element and trace element compositions. And so I guess So this, we're going to look at how the composition changes from going from here to here to generate the salt like at the mid-ocean ridge, and also at arcs where you generate a felsic continental crust and potentially some sort of mafic material down here. And these arrows are meant to indicate that you can form and you can recycle them back into the mantle. And just to show you what partial melting does, these are peridotites. This affects melt extraction. So calcium, aluminum, sodium, platinum, and magnesium. And these are melting trends. These would be peridotites that had melt extracted from. They're all from the lithospheric mantle. And you start off probably somewhere around here. And it turns out that during melting, these three elements are, and we'll come back to this term on Saturday, are incompatible in the solid, meaning that when you melt it, these elements are preferentially swept up into or partitioned into the melt. Therefore, they're depleted in the solid residuum. And magnesium, on the other hand, is more compatible than these guys, and so or it's just more compatible, and it basically gets retained in the solid residuum. So basically, the melt depletion trend in the solid will give you decreasing calcium with increasing magnesium. Okay, and this is kind of what we have to work with. And if you want to, you can look at the entire periodic table to look at a whole gamut of silicate differentiation plots. But a nice one is just to focus on magnesium silica. Here's roughly what the mantle is, and we're going to define that a little bit better. And you melt that, and what you get when you first melt is a basalt, and it has just slightly higher silicate content, very low magnesium. And then this basalt, by some process, will differentiate into more felsic cones. It can either accumulate, and you saw some of that in the tutorial where you were accumulating olivine or crystallizing olivine, plagioclase, and then pyroxene eventually, that you can drive this basalt, this residual liquid, to very felsic or very silicic compositions. So our average composition of the continental crust is up here. Okay. the reason why I'm showing this is that there's a very strong variation in major element chemistry, and these are going to stabilize very different minerals. They're going to, obviously, if you just subduct some of this stuff or recycle some of this stuff, they'd have very different densities, velocities, etc. Okay. So how do we estimate bulk silicate earth composition or the primitive mantle composition? There are four ways, and I'm going to go through them, and they're going to I'm going to end on one which is, I think, we actually do have a very strong constraint, a very robust constraint, on the bulk silicate earth composition. But before I do that, I'll lay out some of the other ways that you might think has some uncertainties, but in the end, it turns out not to be so bad. So the first thing would be, well, maybe we could find a prototype that has never melted before, has never had anything extracted from it. So, okay, well, you go to one of these guys and find this melt depletion trend, and so you know this guy right here has had melt extracted. But the problem with this, so the idea before, one of the original ones by Emil Jagut, was to say, let's go look for the most fertile prototype, and we'll call that primitive mantle. But you don't really know if, by chance, some of your guys were way up here, or folks was up here, and we're just having a biased sampling. Turns out it's not so bad, but of course that assumption is, you know, it's an assumption. So let's try something else. Now another way is the pyrolite model, which is, you look at a basalt. You know basalt came from the mantle, and you go out and you collect peridotites, xenoliths, out in the field, and you look, and they look like, on average, they melted. Okay. And then you say, well, in theory, I should be able to add these two back together, and I should be able to get the primitive mantle. The problem is how you actually add them back together, the proportions, the criteria for how you define the proportions are a little different between each models, and so that's why there are a lot of different pyrolite compositions. So that's also not the best. But the other approach is chondrites, looking at chondrites. And this is actually one thing I'd like to really drive home here. I think my own students, and I hear a lot of, when I ask someone, like, how do we know the bulk, the composition of bulk silicate earth, the natural response is, oh, it's from chondrites. Well, that's only half correct. Okay? And Sujoy touched on this, and so some of these sites are going to be the same, but we're going to elaborate on that. So there are these really, there's a series of undifferentiated meteorites, they're called chondrites, meaning that they have not formed a metallic core, they haven't generated crust, they just never got big enough to get a lot of internal differentiation. And there's a class CI chondrites, which happen to have the same composition as the sun, if you normalize to the silica atoms, except for some volatile elements. And then there are a bunch of other chondrites that we can look at, which are undifferentiated. What we can do is, this is from Alexander, we can just plot them or divide them or normalize them to the CI chondrites and plot them, in this case, versus condensation temperature. And so Sujoy already showed this, so I won't need to really go on that. And so each one of these is a different element. Okay? And what you can see is that things that condense out from the solar nebula at very high temperatures, we call refractory, and these would be highly volatile. But just look at any class of these meteorites. So the green guys here, or the refractory ones are up here, and then the volatile ones are down here. Basically, there's a lot of fractionation between refractory, moderately volatile, and volatile elements, and each meteorite class is somewhat unique. So you're going to say, well, if that's the case, why should the Earth be like any of these chondrites? Okay? The Earth probably came from something that looked like the Earth. So, and its parent body is probably itself. So, so here's also oxygenized. So you can see that, again, the Earth and Moon have similar oxygen isotopic compositions, but it doesn't have the same oxygen isotopic composition as other meteorites. And if you look at isotopes, osmium isotopes, Earth seems to be similar to one of the meteorite classes, but not to the others. And there's really not much internal consistency. And you can also look at aluminum silica ratio, magnesium silica, here are the different meteorite classes, undifferentiated meteorites, and these are peridotites, so I call this a terrestrial array, a melted depletion trend. You can say, okay, let's go up until we think we got some primitive stuff, but our primitive mantle is probably going to lie somewhere around here, and it doesn't match any of those. We could say that we can extrapolate this like Emil Jagrutz did, but you can see even the meteorites don't have the same major element composition. So Earth is made from Earth-like objects, and so it kind of sounds pretty bad. How do we actually determine the composition of the Earth from chondrites? Okay, so actually now, this is the part that if there's anything you get away from this talk, it's this part. So that's why it's in red, and it says remember this. So, okay, so this looks like a mess, but in fact, there is something good in here. I mean, everything looks different for each meteorite class. But if you look in detail, if you just look at these guys, the refractory elements within a given class, okay, the refractory elements are calcium, titanium, rare earth elements, aluminum, scandium. They are within each class, they all have this, they fall on the same line or a flat line, meaning that the relative abundances are the same. It goes for the green guys, purple guys, yellow guys, and of course the chondrites too are going to be the same. So while everything else is different, the refractory element relative abundances are the same in all of the undifferentiated meteorites. So we can maybe make the reasonable assumption that Earth also has its refractory element relative abundance ratios chondritic. Nothing else, just the refractory element ratios. Okay. So if that's the case, then we can use these to kind of start our path to getting bulk silicate earth composition. And in particular, we do want to focus on lithophile elements. Lithophile elements are elements that like silicates, so they stay in the mantle. And we want to stay away from volatile elements, of course, which go in the atmosphere, siderophile elements, which go into the core, like the platinum group elements, calcophile elements that go into sulfides, which may also go into the core. Some of the siderophile elements are actually refractory. They come out very early on in the condensation sequence. But because they go into the core, they're going to get screwed up in the silicate mantle, and we're not going to be able to play any gains from the natural samples that we have available. So focusing only on the lithophile element, refractory lithophile element ratios, this is basically how we get the composition of the bulk silicate earth. So, for example, it's not so important to worry about the axes other than, you know, well, this is scandium-ytterbium ratio, and this is constant in all undifferentiated meteorites, and we make the assertion that bulk silicate earth also has this chondritic ratio. But it turns out during melting that you can actually fractionate this ratio. It just so happens that during melting, this is peridotite again, that ytterbium is preferentially with respect to scandium removed and taken into the melt. So it increases. Titanium right here is incompatible, and so you get this negative trend. So although there's some scatter in the data, what you do is you just regress a line through here and you extrapolate this melt depletion line until you hit the chondritic scandium ytterbium ratio, and at that point you go back down here and you get the titanium concentration. So that's how you go from the ratios to actually getting an absolute abundance of an element in the bulk silicate earth. Okay? And once you have titanium, and you can do this for aluminum, although I didn't show it, but once you have that, yeah, I know, I didn't. And I don't think McDonough and Son did. Yeah, well, there's an uncertainty, but that's how it's done. There's actually, I haven't finished reading it, but Jun Kurunaga is a geophysicist. He decided to come and revisit all of these extrapolations and really look at the uncertainties more rigorously. So, but I don't think the paper's out yet. But yeah, that could be improved. But you get the idea, right? Okay, so. Yeah, there's scatter in the chemical data. So, okay, you get titanium and aluminum concentration in the bulk silicate earth. Let's say we got that. I didn't show it to you. And then you can bootstrap the rest of the way for a lot of elements. So let's just worry about refractory lithified elements. So I know we're talking about major elements, but say you want the uranium concentration of the bulk silicate earth. You know that uranium is a refractory element, so, and it doesn't go into the core. And so we know that the bulk silicate earth has a uranium aluminum ratio equal to chondrite. So all you have to do is take now what you just did in the previous figure, the aluminum or titanium concentration, multiply this, and you get the uranium. Is that simple? Okay. And now for other elements that may not be refractory or may not be perfectly lithophile, what you would do is say, I should have focused on this one. Like, for example, sodium could be a little bit volatile, but you go through this process. We say we got magnesium. That's why I did it. Yeah, aluminum versus magnesium. Here's the melt depletion trend. I can, in order for me to get the magnesium concentration of the bulk silicate earth, I already know my aluminum. I just go up, intersect this, and there's my magnesium. Then through that, I can get sodium by extrapolating up to here. And yeah, there's a lot of scatter here, but these guys should have been filtered out. They actually have there's some metasomatic effects. But this is basically, you can use peridotites coupled with some information from chondrites to get the bulk silicate earth composition. Okay. So it's actually quite simple, and these are fairly robust estimates. And some other things, some elements you can't do it this way. And there's one other approach for a certain element is that there are some ratios of incompatible elements that just don't get fractionated during any silicate differentiation processes. And so, for example, potassium uranium is always about 10 to the fourth. You can plot it versus all different types of rocks. Primitive to evolved ones right here, and so now I already showed you we got uranium. Well, now we can get potassium, okay? And when you get the potassium uranium ratio of the bulk silicate earth, of course, it turns out it's lower than the chondrite ratio. So normally I don't like to show tables in talks, but since this will be on the web and you guys can just access it, here are the tables for you, and more tables for major elements just to compare. They seem to all converge on each other. I don't know if that's groupthink or what is it. And then some more stuff here. So that's just for your reference. Okay. So all right. I think any questions? But I think what I just wanted to get across is that there are some constraints on the bulk silicate earth major element composition, and now you kind of know how it's done. In fact, you can just do it all yourself. You know. Okay, so yeah. You mean the four methods there? You can assess that yourself by looking at this one. It turns out that looking for the most fertile one. But it wasn't so bad. Actually, I'll come back to that. It's kind of remarkable that they match. The pure chondrite one obviously doesn't match. And pyrite ones also are fairly close, at least in terms of major elements. So they're all actually not too far apart. Okay. So major element. So now we have our starting point. And let's talk about major element heterogeneity. And you saw that. There's a lot of major element variation. Some of the issues are how much basaltic oceanic crust is down there. And I'm not going to tell you because I don't know. But you can play games. You can say, well, how much basaltic oceanic crust could have gone down there, and by just looking at spreading rates and integrating through time. Another issue is how much delaminated material is there. And in fact, if you, there's this, slightly an aside, but if you look at the average composition of the continental crust, it's right here. And if you look at incompatible trace elements, the most incompatible one is the continental crust, which only makes up about 0.3% by mass of the entire mantle. Accounts for a huge component, 50% of all the really most incompatible elements 50% of the entire bulk silicate earth budget is right here in this sky, 0.3% of the mass of the mantle. And so you know that the conical crust must have got these, a lot of the inclinations from the mantle, but when you melt the mantle in terms of measurements, you can't get here unless you add a lot of water. So what you get is a basalt, and so if the conical crust is over here, you actually have to get rid of some mafic component that's over here, either as cumulus or some sort of mafic residue. And the proportions, and this was the subject of a Penrose conference that I was just at last week, the proportions could be like huge, 1-to-1 ratio, and those are missing. Those are pretty much missing. And they're mafic, they're like eclogites, and those could have gone into the mantle. Okay. And then another issue is how much hartsburgite or depleted peridotites. I guess I got a few slides out of order, but and so this is another table for you, just giving you proportions or masses. Okay. And oh, this is the one I want to show. So in addition to forming oceanic crust and subducting oceanic crust, you also generate a depleted residuum. And so if you cross the solidus at for a given potential temperature here, so a more likely one is right here, 1350 or so, and so you cross it here, you would generate this depleted mantle residuum. Hartsburgite would be the really shallow stuff, and it would gradually grade down to a more fertile peridotite, like a larizolite. But the whole thing goes, whole thing subducts. So it's not just oceanic crust, it's also the oceanic lithospheric mantle. And so the question is, can we detect any of these heterogeneities, either geochemically or geophysically? And I think I'm going to focus on more the geophysics. And so the issue is, are there some compositional effects on seismic velocities? And I just want to look at peridotites and eclogites, which are would be oceanic crust or delaminated lower crust. And so eclogites could form here or here. And there are plenty of papers on seismic velocities, but this is just a convenient one that came out from Ferrado's group just recently. And here's shear wave, P wave velocity for different minerals. These are actually for ultramafic systems, but garnet has the highest velocities, olivine next, and then you've got the pyroxenes down here. And the major element composition, so the composition of your system, of these guys right here, will dictate how much clinopyroxene or garnet you have, or how much olivine, this is spinel here, or clinopyroxene you have. And the mineral modes are going to basically control the velocities. So this is just a nice figure to see who's controlling what. Okay. So let's look at peridotites first. Are we ever going to be able to see differences in the spectrum of peridotites that you might expect from partial melting? Okay. And if we want to do that, we would like to find some useful scaling of velocities versus some parameter. And the parameter that we think would be useful is one that actually has some geodynamic significance. It would not be very interesting to plot it versus sodium. So one is MG number, which is, and you'll probably see geochemists talk about this a lot, but it's just the molar magnesium of the whole rock divided by the magnesium plus iron multiplied by 100. Okay? And why is this important? Well, here's another melt depletion trend in peridotites. So it's MG number and olivine mode. And what happens as you melt is MG number increases because you start to deplete iron a little bit, and you increase the magnesium. And you also change the olivine mode, so the pyroxenes start to gradually move out. And because of this depletion in iron, you actually decrease the density along this path. And so decrease the density is important, well, obviously, for genetic implications. So that's why maybe this is an index that we'd like to play with and see how velocities scale with that. Okay. So how does seismic velocity vary with MG number? Well, the information we need are mineral chemistries and mineral proportions. And Lars already showed you can calculate all of this theoretically for fairly simple systems. And we kind of took an unsophisticated approach, which was just to collect a whole bunch of mantle xenoliths, hoping to get the entire natural range of composition, and then calculate their seismic velocities. And in this case, you know the mineral proportions because you can see it. You can count them, or you can measure them, or do an inversion, major element data to get the mineral modes, and then you can get the elastic moduli, and you average them appropriately, and then you get the shear and P wave velocities as a function of MG number. So shear wave velocity shows some correlation with MG number, whereas P wave velocity doesn't. The reason for this is that there is more sensitivity to shear modulus on the four-stripe phthalate proportions in olivine, and then P wave is actually much more sensitive to the modes of olivine and orthopyroxene. And in natural perturbites, this olivine orthopyroxene ratio actually can be disturbed by secondary effects. So we see really not much correlation with MG number for P wave velocities. If I actually plot it versus olivine mode, there's a nice correlation. Okay. So there is some compositional effect on shear wave velocities, and these are, of course, just purely elastic. No anelastic effects are accounted for here. I probably should have put the percentages here just so you can read it quickly. But the whole variation is actually not very much. We're talking about 1 to 2% variation in shear wave velocity over the entire range of what we could probably get in a mantle. And it's quite unlikely that, say, an oceanic lithospheric mantle that you'd ever get MG numbers of 94. You only get these guys up in cratons, cratonic mantle. So the real variation we're going to expect to see maybe even smaller. Okay? And the temperature effect is much larger than this. Okay. The one hope is maybe to look at the ratio P to S wave velocities. There's not much variation here. There is here, so there's a negative correlation of VP-VS ratios with MG number. So that might hold some promise, except when you get to high temperatures where attenuation effects, like the stuff that Colin was talking about, start to mess with the shear wave velocity. So again, VP-VS ratios were probably only going to work in comparing regions within cratons rather than cratons or to oceans. Okay. I do have density, and actually it's way at the end of the talk. I don't know why I didn't put it up here, but yeah. So eclogites, we could have a whole talk on just what Cattrall is on, all the different types of eclogites and names we have, but I just put them all up here, and they're just poly versus magnesium in this case. Density, pyrrhotite density is about 3.38 for a fertile mantle, so this is down here. And so all eclogites are very dense. That's because they have pyroxene and garnets. And then P wave velocities, shear wave velocities. Here's my pyrrhotite field. You can see a number of eclogites actually have high P wave velocities. Some are actually indistinguishable from pyrrhotite. Shear wave velocities, there's a considerable overlap with eclogites. VP, VS, or convert that to Poisson's ratio, are much higher than pyrrhotites, which are down here about 1.71. So, I think looking for pyrrhotite, the spectrum of pyrrhotite seismically, I think that it's going to be a challenge. If it's big enough, you could see the eclogites pretty well. Okay. I guess one of the things, so for eclogites we could see seismically, we could probably also see geochemically using oxygen isotopes. But one of the things that I myself have been struggling with was how would we, if this material, this depleted stuff, was subducted and and returned or recycled back into the upper mantle, would we be able to detect it? And maybe we'd have to rely on geochemistry. And there's a number of reasons why this might actually be important. If you cross the solidus, the dry solidus right here, this is the wet melting, and Mark has updated this significantly. But if we just look at where you cross the dry solidus, this part would be dehydrated. And one thing with dehydration is that Greg Hirth had shown long ago, is that you get an increase in viscosity. So here's temperature, depth. This is some estimate of this dehydrated layer. And you could increase the viscosity by a factor of almost 100. And so, of course, it's cold, so it's highly viscous. But there's this jump right here. And this huge increase in viscosity might be able to keep this thing around. So this is stuff that Agent Lenardic was playing around with. And what he did was to just take a slightly buoyant or Hartzsprungitic residuum, make it really viscous so it doesn't get stretched out. So basically, as it subducts because it's cold at first, and then it kind of rotates around here and it hits the bottom. And when it thermally re-equilibrates, it eventually rises up on its own accord because it's just slightly chemically buoyant. And so one of the questions is whether some plumes might have been initiated by Hartzsprungites. Of course, all of this assumes that the oceanic crust and Hartzsprungitic residuum are removed, which may not be the case, in which case it won't be very interesting. What is the, that? This entire mantle here. Yeah. So, I guess I went through this pretty fast. Oh, okay, yeah. So, I'm going to leave off with more a question, I suppose. Is the Earth's mantle compositionally stratified, or was it compositionally stratified? There may be some reasons to think that it may have been, at least in the beginning. And so this is a paper from Rick Carlson, a review paper, kind of borrowed some stuff from Carl Agee. But on the moon, we know there was a magma ocean, and during early on in its history, entire mantle, or almost all of the mantle, was molten. So all in a liquid state. As it cools, it should start to crystallize. And because the crystals have different densities in the liquid, they start to segregate. Okay. And so the first thing is actually to come out of a liquid, a primary liquid, would be probably olivine. And the olivine in particular is going to be magnesium-rich. And as you take the magnesium-rich olivine out of the liquid has a little bit less magnesium, so then the next olivine that comes out is going to be a little bit more iron-rich. Okay? So the thing with iron is, the more iron-rich you are in olivine, the denser you are. So what happens is, the first guys crystallize with these low MG number, low density olivines, and then the next thing that comes out would be the high iron olivines, which are denser, and you can potentially get a inverted stratification in terms of density. And in the case of the Earth, where you have much higher pressures, some of the olivines might actually float up here, but you're still going to get this kind of differentiation of olivines with different MG numbers. And here's a paper by Lindy Elkins-Tanton and Sarah Zarenek, and they looked at Mars, and I guess Sarah can talk about this much more, but basically they have the model of what the mineralogy that might crystallize out during magma ocean on Mars, and the initial density profile that they predict is this thing right here, which of course is unstable. And what they then did was some simple models two different guys. We'll just look at this one, I guess, where this is the, I guess, the uncompressed density, right?
Yeah, these are
the colors. Yeah, so incompressible. So these colors represent densities, and then it's unstable, and you get an overturn. And what was important was that they show that you get this dense layer right here that actually can stick around for a while. And so the question is whether something like this happens on the Earth. You might expect maybe the lower parts of the mantle, lower loosely defined, might be more iron-rich. So to address that, This has been suggested many times before, but I'm going to kind of look at it again. So if we know the bulk silicate, so this is the core, not the scale, but if we know the bulk silicate earth composition with all this green stuff right here, then the question we should ask is, what is the composition of the upper accessible part of mantle, this yellow part here? And if, in terms of major elements, we find that it matches the bulk silicate earth, we don't worry about the trace elements because, with the major elements, we don't worry about the continental crust because it's only 0.3% of the mass, so it doesn't do a whole lot in terms of major elements. But if this yellow thing right here has the same major element composition as the green thing, then there's no obvious evidence that the Earth, at least today, is stratified in terms of major elements. It can still be stratified in terms of incompatible elements, trace elements, but... okay, so how do we address this? Well, again, we can take this melt residue trend and magnesium versus aluminum. These are prototypes from all over the place, xenoliths, massifs, ophiolites. And this is, you don't want to just take the average of this and say that that's the average of the upper mantle, because these are in the lithosphere. They've already gone through a melting process that was involved in the process that made them into lithosphere. But what you really want to focus on is more of this end. Okay, go look at the most fertile end and see, do you get anything that kind of matches the bulk silicate earth? And what is kind of interesting is you don't really get many that shoots out beyond what we think the bulk silicate earth, magnesium, and aluminum concentrations are, but it kind of starts to peter out right about here. You could say that within error, they're exactly the same, that the source of these guys came from right here. Our fertile mantle, upper parts of the mantle, loosely defined, is the same as the bulk silicate earth. So there's no obvious evidence for chemical stratification. But what I'd like to do is say, well, let's relax this and say, what if we had this whole range right here as the plus as what our bulk what our upper mantle composition might be in terms of magnesium? Okay, what would that imply? How iron or rich or magnesium poor could the lower part of the mantle be? So how much room do we have to play with? And so this is just iron. You can do the same there. Mg number might be a little bit more informative. Here's my circle, and I say, okay, let's assume that our upper mantle, the maximum tolerable amount that our upper mantle could have in terms of a change in Mg number from the bulk silicate earth is somewhere between 88 and 90. Okay, if it's 90, it would mean that the lower mantle has got to be on this side, so lower Mg number. And so here you can plot Mg number of upper mantle, Mg number of lower mantle, bulk silicate earth here, bulk silicate earth there. Okay, so that would be, they're all identical. And each of these lines would be curves for different assumptions on how big we think the upper mantle that we sample from prototypes is, how representative it is. So if we think it's half of the entire earth, entire silicate part of the earth, then what this would imply is that if our upper mantle had an Mg number of 90, then the lower mantle must have an Mg number of 88 if they are divided in those proportions. Okay, 88. And I don't know what these proportions are, so it's highly uncertain. But the point is, these are kind of some of the, I would say, the maximum tolerable bounds for what the lower mantle Mg number ought to be, 88 or 87. Yeah. Well, I don't think it's circular. The reason why I don't think it's circular is the following. Because when we let me show this one. Okay. When you do this, it could have been, okay, that when we got a melt depletion trend, we could have only had samples from here, and we just keep extrapolating out to places where we don't even have any data, and from chondritic refractive element ratios. So there's no reason. So what is actually remarkable is that the most fertile prototypes that you have are in fact similar to what you predict the bulk silicate earth composition is. A priori, it didn't have to be that way. Does that make sense?
And this one referring to the fertile.
Okay. Right. It's defined by these trends, right? But it could have been that our trend. So our data actually go all the way out. It's not like we actually have. Let me give another example. If it was stratified, we had data that were coming up over here, but no data here. We would still extrapolate out to where we hit this point and we get this titanium concentration, even though what we're sampling is coming from a mantle that's already significantly depleted in titanium. So I don't think that it sounds circular, but it's not a circular argument. It looks circular because actually our most fertile ones that kind of match the titanium constant, our most fertile prototypes actually do overlap where we extrapolate it to be. That. Oh, well, yeah, well, guessing with it. I can talk to you more about it. I don't think it's actually circular because anyway, let me move on. But, yeah. That's the independent control. And in the other case, I'm taking the most fertile one, which didn't have to match the intersection. Yeah, so that's what I was trying to explain. So it's not circular. But what you end up finding is that, well, your projected composition is not that different from the most fertile ones. And I think that agrees with most people. And I was just trying to show, well, if it didn't project out, I mean, if it didn't match that projection, what is the maximum tolerable limit you can have? And in fact, the lower Mallet could at most be MG number of 87 or 88. And dynamically, what would that mean? You can look at the density versus MG number, and this is bulk silicate earth. Now let's extrapolate out to what the lower Mallet. Of course, this is all at STP, so this trend could change. But just as a almost a back of the envelope calculation, extrapolate out to say 88 or 87, and then you can say, well, how much temperature anomaly do you need to in fact cause this hypothetical dense layer, which is not really even that, I mean, iron rich? How much temperature anomaly do you need to get it to at least be neutrally buoyant? And so here's temperature, here's MG number, and here's the curve, unstable, stable. And if I go just to 88, you only need about 100 degrees, which is not really that much. So I guess the question that I posed would be that the answer, at least my opinion, is that at least today, the mantle is probably not significantly stratified in terms of major elements, unless there's a very, very small enriched reservoir down at the core mantle boundary. Okay, so I think that's it. I think the most important thing for this talk is really how do you get the bulk silicate earth composition, and then we talked about some of the seismic velocity effects, and then some more kind of speculative stuff. Okay, that's it.